Chapter 10, Exodus, 1996 to 2001. The situation is desperate, but not serious. Greg drove me away from the prison camp on a Friday. My fellow inmates all thought I was rich, and I would have hired a limousine if I could have spared the bucks just for the show, but it was a gag too far. The next day, Greg flew off to Alaska for 9 days of salmon fishing. Jim, with his peculiar sense of humor, came by and took me to see the movie Independence Day, a science fiction eyeball overload thriller with massive computer-generated special effects, to get my system going 1 day removed from 5 years of sensory deprivation. I came out of the theater shaking and sweating. Next, he said he'd set me up with a date, what with my having been away from women for so long, and dropped me off to see Morning Star for an hour. She was a rainbow sister who was about 40, but looked much older than her parents, with whom she lived temporarily. This was due to her obsession with tobacco. Her skin looked like it had been cured for months in a smokehouse. She couldn't light up in the house, and so spent most of her time outside. Between hacking coughs on the porch, she squinted her bleary eyes at me and said, through yellowed teeth, that she didn't believe the doctor's diagnosis of emphysema, or that it was caused by cigarettes. As I didn't partake myself, there wasn't much for us to talk about, and I was relieved to make my escape when Jim came to pick me up. I was not her Marlboro man. To get around, I borrowed Jim's mountain bike, which was painful and barely possible to use, and relied on the Charlotte bus system. Usually, I was the only white rider, and from time to time, I would meet former inmates. While they were all friendly, it was nerve-wracking. Getting anywhere by bus took at least an hour each way. I went to visit my parole officer, and he took one look at me and my papers and said, "Phone me up once a month." He had actual criminals to attend to. That was the last time I saw him, and parole ended in October. Now that I was on my own, I had no medical care and no income. Some friends very kindly pitched in enough for me to get by, but things were very difficult. I trained for 3 weeks on Photoshop in Jim's studio, and then he gave me a job for a few hours 2 or 3 days a week. This was enough to leave me exhausted. Putting in more than 10 or 15 hours a week was not possible, so I wasn't going to be able to support myself. I needed to be certified as disabled all over again to get Medicaid and SSI, as well as food stamps. The world was very confusing and frequently hostile. At a local library, I had my first experience of this internet thing I had heard so much about. I went to a terminal, someone told me how to sign on, and the first thing that came on the screen was a neo-Nazi page with pictures of Hitler and giant swastikas. That's odd, I thought. Later, I found it also had email and porn. My lawyer's secretary had been saying that she had no idea where my diaries and photographs were, although they had been entrusted to my lawyer by the federal court. Luck was with me, and Marshall Bickett got a new secretary, who found them after some considerable rummaging. I took the bus to Salisbury for a reunion with Don Gale and Bickett in the courthouse. It was quite odd to be surrounded by people who had done so much to harm and deceive me, and who mostly still treated me like dirt. Retrieval of these documents made this book possible. On parting at the bus station, Don said he hoped I wouldn't be involved with LSD again, as he wouldn't want to bust me once more. After doing so much harm to me that lasted so many years, he was actually being friendly and respectful, where other people couldn't witness. In late August, a vanload of plainclothes police came to the door to search the house for drugs. They said a neighbor had reported me walking down the street smoking a joint, which I hadn't done for 20 years. They found nothing, since there was nothing to find, but on the way out, the last one said, "You can tell us if you've been smoking dope. It's okay. You can trust us." I showed him the door. Also in late August, I visited Rainbow Weaver in Chapel Hill. She drove me over to the newly constructed main building at Kindness House, where we had a meeting with Bo and Sita Lozoff and a dinner with the residents. I was keen on the idea of joining the ashram, since it was all about love and chanting and devotion to my guru and selfless service. But some things struck me as a touch strange. Bo said they didn't want people who had problems with authority, and smoking one cigarette would result in immediate expulsion. I wasn't sure where he was going to find ex-cons with that kind of admission policy. In fact, there were none yet. They had a pledge for all members to sign that had a list of austerities, including celibacy and obedience. Bo and Sita didn't have to sign, since they were taken as special and spiritually evolved. Ex-prisoners couldn't leave the compound without permission and were escorted when away. Bo would threaten those on parole with revocation and re-imprisonment if they broke rules or talked back, even though he did not have this power. Ashram residents would bunk 4 to a room and were allowed half a backpack of possessions. Compensation for working all day every day was room and board plus $50 a month with no medical care. The handful living there struck me as timid and passive and from traumatic pasts. One was a refugee from the Hare Krishnas, and others had similar histories. Dinner was tense, as we all tried to be on our best behavior and be all spiritual and such. I noticed that all other religions and methods were mocked, which was not a good sign. When I showed Bo a translation of the Hanuman Chalisa by an Indian devotee who used somewhat flowery Indian English, he ridiculed the book. Something just wasn't smelling right. Still, I wanted to join, since I thought that the work with inmates was valuable, and the chance to be in an ashram centered around Neem Karoli Baba was extremely rare. The only other such ashram in the country was in Taos. They didn't think my residence was a very good idea unless I tried staying for a very short visit to try it out, which was prudent. I proposed bringing my own housing in the form of a teepee, then later an RV. They turned these ideas down. They wanted residents to have no social life, no outside interests, no personal freedom, and no activities other than service to the ashram. Humor was unwelcome. They said that if I joined, it could destroy their group and drive them insane, much to my surprise. I found this offensive and absurd, and asked them to take me off their mailing list. A couple of years later, Rainbow Weaver introduced me to Peace, one of the few ex-inmates who moved to Kindness House. He was about 60, with long hair and bushy white beard, very much the hippie. He'd been arrested for something not terribly serious in Pennsylvania, probably weed, but when paroled, he split for California. They brought him back and put him in prison for parole violation. When he was paroled again, he went back to California, was arrested again, and so on over and over. By the time he'd been paroled to Kindness House, he'd been in prison for 25 years, mostly for going to California while on parole, for going to California while on parole, for going to California ad infinitum. Eventually, Pennsylvania tired of footing the bill for this nonsense, but instead of simply paroling him to California and ending the problem, they paroled him to North Carolina. Sending him to California would be giving him what he wanted, instead of teaching this hippie a lesson about authority. Peace chafed under the severe restrictions at Kindness House. Friends got together and arranged for him to have a little apartment in Chapel Hill and a modest job at a store. I visited his apartment, where he told me about how great California was. I pleaded with him to just sit tight in this situation for a few more months. Then he'd be done with parole and could go to California without being a fugitive. He seemed to agree that this made sense. A week later, the apartment was empty, as Pease had escaped to California once again. I finally figured out that Bo was the boss man of a cult, and in 2000 I wrote him a couple of letters about this. He responded with foul language, which he often employed while losing his temper, and that was the end of our contact. Just as with so many other spiritual groups, the celibacy requirement emasculated the other men, leaving the women horny and available to the alpha male. Sita considered anything Bo did to be inspired and ordained by God, including affairs with women residents in the ashram, even a random sacred blowjob from a first-time visitor in Bo's office. By 2005, his sexual misconduct forced the end of Kindness House, but Human Kindness Foundation continued. In 2008, Independent Weekly printed an article titled The Two Faces of Bo Lozoff, detailing the situation. Bo and Sita and the core members thought of this as a conspiracy by bitter convicts. After the article, Bo had a harder time locally, and so he moved to Hawaii. There he sings rock and roll in bars and bills himself as a yoga teacher and inspirational author on iHanuman.com. Many people give him lavish praise. I move into subterranean digs. In early October, I moved across town to live in the basement of my friend I'll call Janice, who let me stay there for free while I got back on my feet. It had a bathroom and a fridge, which made it practical. The house was built on a steep hill, so I had my own entrance to the yard and could avoid disturbing her privacy. Janice did not want me to come upstairs to use her washer and dryer, so to do laundry, I had to carry my clothes in a large duffel bag to the nearest bus stop, then across a shopping center to the laundromat. With my bum hip, this was excruciating. Later, Janice had knee replacement surgery, experienced the pain, and profusely apologized for making me do this. Janice said that before my arrest, Big Bob made a couple of purchases from his terrific customer, then found himself in a room surrounded by policemen. They told him he would never get out of prison unless he cooperated and helped set up his supplier for arrest and prosecution. He never spent a night in jail. Big Bob was careful not to let anyone know about this, or I would have heard through many mutual friends. This didn't keep him from dealing pot later on. Oh well. In October, Jim and I loaded up our kayak gear and went to Baylog Sail Design's annual Born to Raise Sail gathering at Cedar Island on the Outer Banks. We met Jim Brown, great trimaran designer, and had some wonderful sailing. But I couldn't handle the boats anymore and needed money desperately. I met a couple there who lived on the road in their camping trailer and were interested in my Klepper and sailing rig. Later, they came to Charlotte, and I sold it all to them. Later, I found a buyer for my wooden single. This was the end of my boating life and an inspiration to think about living on the road myself. Looking around for local spiritual groups, I visited the local Hindu center. But as the only cowboy in a room full of Indians, I couldn't connect. Next, I tuned into the Charlotte Zen scene. I sat with them weekly for most of a year, but it was not satisfying. I wanted a quiet, concentrated mind in pure awareness, but there wasn't any devotion or sense of growing closer to God in this path. Staring at the wall just didn't do it for me. It clearly was designed to get Japanese past problems that are endemic in that culture, but I am not Japanese, something I learned in some detail while macrobiotic. 1997, Life in the Slow Lane. In January, I bought an old station wagon for $750 and relished scratching my very itchy feet. Now, a visit to the library wouldn't require 3 hours of travel time on the bus. I'd had several visions relating to moving to somewhere between Nashville and West Virginia, and so I was eager to be mobile as soon as I could. In contrast to my life before prison, my spiritual practice was now a regular daily routine with pranayama, chanting, and meditation before dawn most days. As a result, I had a long series of very high experiences that were sometimes clear and sometimes completely bewildering, frequently with Nin Karoli Baba involved, writing on the thought forums, as Ram Dass put it. Rainbow Weaver's two children, ages 11 and 15, were living with her, and I could drive from time to time to Chapel Hill to visit. Although we had gone through ups and downs, and she did not visit while I was in prison, we were very close. She had gone through many dramas during my prison years. For instance, one of her boyfriends blew out his brains with a shotgun, and she found the body, a trauma that took some time to heal. There were serious lifestyle differences between us that kept us from being mates, much to my regret. Her extremely difficult childhood left her with severe problems that I found perplexing. Soon she had a new boyfriend, whom she'd been seeing from time to time since December. After 2 months of waiting to get into a free clinic to get current medical records for SSI and Medicaid appeals, I saw a doctor and had x-rays of my left hip. Then I saw an orthopedic surgeon who was emphatic that I needed surgery, probably including an implant of cadaver bone. Even by prison standards, this was gruesome. I couldn't possibly do this living in a basement and with no benefits, so surgery would just have to wait. In the spring, Ram Dass had a severe stroke, which was devastating for all the many people who love him and owe him so much for his guidance and example over the years. After a prolonged recovery, he was able to continue writing and speaking at events, although with long, thoughtful pauses as he searched for words. Finally, in August, my SSI was granted, with a check including back pay from when I first applied fresh out of prison. $1,000 went to my lawyer in return for his sending a few letters. I renovated a 12-foot square space in Jim's garage and moved in to prepare for my operation. Time for a technical paragraph. Don't worry, it is brief. In case of nosebleed, you may skip it without becoming disoriented. My research had gone from sonoluminescence to cold fusion. I was intrigued by the various reports of lingering anomalies in several labs and hoped to propose an experiment to make a practical reactor with a high and unambiguous power density. As a result, I studied detonation shock waves through aerosols and the reactions of fine powders of titanium, nickel, and lithium in hydrogen or deuterium gases. Although it got quite intricate, none of the proposals were realistic. I was in correspondence with a company called Z-Power Corporation, based in Phoenix, for several years for backing and setting up a lab, but nothing came of it. You can't fool Mother Nature. In early September, Anton wrote from England, back from a summer in the Far East. He'd met James Lansdale, brother of longtime Manila CIA station chief Edward Lansdale, who said he was 99 years old but looked 45 due to eating living food and periodic month-long fasts. James claimed to be the titular head of Alpha Omega, the secret government, behind the governments going back to 34,000 BC, and which was now setting up the New World Order. James invited Anton to his Pentagon office in October to introduce him to the major players in Washington. Also, in Indonesia, he met with the Raja Muda of Perlis, and then with the spiritual guardians of a vast treasure entrusted to them by King Solomon that would be released to the world in 1998. The treasure was overseen by a 400-year-old saint and kept under a spiritual cloak so that no one could find it. in Singapore, Count Albert Chang of the Kingdom of Colonia St. John told of his travels to Tibet and the sacred hidden city. Count considered himself an incarnation of a Chinese emperor, whose many lifetimes of spiritual practice allowed him to see and handle the sacred treasure. I couldn't quite see how the goal of lifetimes of spiritual practice was to be able to play with rocks and little bits of shiny metal. The periodic missives from Anton were certainly entertaining. Finally, I had my total hip revision in mid-September. It went much better than the first time, and I was out in 13 days, walking on new plastic, steel, and a chunk of someone's second-hand pelvis. I got off crutches in a month, but kept on the prison-issue cane, which I called my mugger-whacker. It was a solid oak job, which lasted several years until I left it at a gas station. 1998. I started plotting my next adventure. Jim was going to marry his girlfriend Laura in September, and I was getting underfoot and rather in the way. I needed to find a new place to hang my pith helmets by August. I applied for subsidized housing, but the only available apartments had no white residents. There was ample reason to fear living there. Staying in North Carolina was uncomfortable to me due to my recent judicial unpleasantness, and I wanted to be as mobile as possible while finding my new home turf. Ideally, I wanted to find a suitable spiritual community, but that would take some serious travel. So I started considering selling my car and buying an old motorhome with a recumbent bicycle as short-range transportation. Rainbow introduced me to a NASCAR mechanic living down the street from her who had a 1973 Winnebago Indian, 22 feet long, that was for sale. In late March, we took a close look at it, and I drove it around the block. The water tank and the manifold gasket needed work, which he agreed to fix, but everything else seemed fine. I gave a hefty down payment, as it would be early June before I could pick it up. I wanted to get everything rigged and down the road to the next rainbow gathering in Arizona, as always during the first week of July. I wrote a note to the Armageddon Time Arc Base in Weslaco, Texas, who were at the 1990 gathering handing out information about their 5D technology and monadic gravity. It was like the Church of the Subgenius, except they were serious. I couldn't resist and wanted to join the Cosmic Corps of Engineers of the Positive Section of the Outer Dimensional Forces, who offered, for the first time in 6,000 years, exclusive information on a video cassette for a nominal fee. But they were down by Brownsville, hundreds of miles off my usual routes, and I never managed to get down there. Couldn't tell if they'd done too much acid or not enough. In May, I sent off a check for a used recumbent bike. It was a big challenge to ride with my fused back, since balancing was more difficult than with a standard bike, and I was quite frightened of falling over in traffic. But it was fast and easy to pedal, and very light, as well as suitably eccentric. It was no longer possible for me to even try riding conventional bikes, or as we recumbent riders call them, wedgies. In early June, I went to Chapel Hill and paid the balance for the Winnebago. The total price was $4,500. The first night I tried sleeping in the rig, I was chased out by horrendous gas fumes. Turns out the gas lines from the two tanks were corroded and full of holes. After that was fixed, I still had gas stench from a leaking carburetor, which left a pool of gasoline resting on top of the engine right under my bed. It only caught on fire once, thankfully while I was working on it and not while driving. I noticed that nothing on board worked like it had when I first toured the vehicle. the mechanic had taken the time between my deposit and final delivery to switch out various items and replace them with broken ones, such as the cracked toilet. The water tank was hopelessly full of holes from corrosion. The generator, which had worked before, would only run for 10 minutes at a time, then after a few weeks wouldn't start at all. The propane heater also would not function well. The manifold seal was not repaired as promised, leading to exhaust fumes into the cabin and terrible noise. The roof leaked around the many vents and openings. The seals around the windows had corroded and let in water through the walls, rotting most of the plywood inner lining. I used the microwave oven to store canned food. Mice and rats had free and easy entry through many holes in the floor. The only things that worked were the lights, the propane and electric refrigerator, and the stove. This was a huge rip-off. But with a lot of work, I could make it into a comfy, if rudimentary, backcountry-capable RV. I did not plan on paying for camping sites, except on special occasions. Jim had some solar panels he'd bought second-hand that he had no use for, and I stashed them to install later. I made my own water system with 5-gallon plastic jugs and gravity feed, with a solar shower bag in the shower stall. The sewage tank leaked, and since it was polyurethane, it resisted all attempts to seal over an entire year until I just gave up. The toilet was cracked, and eventually I threw it away and put a cap over the hole, plus fresh plywood to replace the rot. I got a hassock-style camping toilet, and for the next 3 years manhandled my own sewage. This gave me great respect for indoor plumbing. With this setup, I could live on 2 gallons of water a day. I rigged a block and tackle on the back of the RV and used it to hoist my recumbent bike vertically. I had an old desktop computer that I bolted to a desk, along with this printer and monitor, but clearly this was not going to work for long. There was a ton of maintenance to do, which would be my main labor for the next year, but it was possible, after 2 weeks of hard work, to drive to Texas. And so, after a flurry of paperwork and preparations for mail forwarding and such, I said goodbye to North Carolina forever and drove off to Nashville to visit my uncle, aunt, and mom. I managed to be civil with my narc cousin, but it was a trial. She had bookshelves filled with volumes on how to prosecute the war on drugs and lock up people like me. Burns was too ill to visit in the nursing home, unconscious and waiting to die. Our social ignorance of the nature of physical death required the nursing staff to force his body to stay alive and prolong his suffering as long as possible, for a price. Rainbow or bust. Next stop was Ponder, Texas, 10 miles west of Denton, to park on Ulysses Lawn. Bacchus has considerable mechanical skills, and there was 14,000 pounds of truck needing serious maintenance before heading to the wide open spaces. His help was invaluable and made the whole enterprise possible. Now I could share the joy of crawling under the rig with raw sewage dripping on our faces in 105-degree heat. He rebuilt the carburetor, ground and sealed my exhaust system, ending my manifold miseries, and repaired my steering column after the RV refused to turn to the right. I spent much time on the roof, rebuilding the evaporative cooler and installing large plastic bins for extra storage. These old Winnebagos had 3/4-inch plywood on the roof, and with all that stuff stored up there as well, curves at any speed were a test of skill and nerve. I could feel the rectangular cross-section distort out of right angles and back again. I got used to watching tree branches very carefully as I hit a good many of them. I looked around for anyone who might want a ride to the Arizona Rainbow Gathering, and found Fern, a 20-year-old hippie with 2 yippie canines in tow. Ulysses had divorced his wife some time previously, so he found Fern's company welcome. At 42, I felt like an old man. Since 3/4 of those going to rainbow gatherings are under 25, this feeling was only just beginning. Heavy maintenance delayed our start, but Fern and I finally hit the road for parts west. We drove across the New Mexico high desert and into Arizona at Springerville, and then on to Sholo. Most of the forests in that region are burning as I write this in the summer of 2011. Even in an old beat-up rig, motorhomes are the way to travel in style. I did all the driving, but Fern could fetch me cold water from the fridge. I endured the two little dogs, and thankfully they did not get between the brake pedal and the floor. The aerodynamics were roughly the same as a grand piano, with crosswinds adding considerable excitement. The picture window up front gave an amazing view. In the mountains I frequently drove, leaning far forward with my face near the glass to take it all in. Gas was relatively inexpensive, probably for the last time in history, so getting 6.5 miles per gallon was not terribly critical. I minimized my mileage anyway. The front tank held 32 gallons and the back tank 18, so a stop at a gas station was a considerable investment, even at $1.50 a gallon. We arrived at the gathering on the morning of July 4th, and I managed to get to the main circle 15 minutes before the breaking of silence at noon with a group chanting of Om. This was always the high point of gatherings for me, being one of 20,000 people together in this one sacred moment. One day in the woods, I came across Morning Star, the woman I met the day after getting out of prison. She was in a wheelchair with an oxygen tank, with a helpful friend pushing her where she needed to go over the challenging terrain. She insisted that cigarettes did not cause her emphysema. Slowly it dawned on me that I had outgrown the rainbow tribe. There was one fellow who showed me his little devices that consisted of quartz crystals wrapped in thick copper wire with bits of leather and feathers and such all stuck together for a maximal transcendental effect. But then there was this other fellow dressed in a long cape with a large crystal mounted on his staff who claimed to be in charge of all the crystals and their energy at the gathering, so these two characters had to stay clear of one another. Now that I wasn't involved with psychedelics, there was little I had to offer that the others valued, and little that they offered that I wanted. My declining health made the gathering an endurance contest, even with my relatively palatial motorhome. And the nail in my hippie-time coffin was staying at the gathering until July 10th. Like most people, I had always left not long after the 4th of July. Now, despite the daily rains and resultant mud, I took part in the vision circles, where the next gathering site was chosen. All decisions had to be by consensus, and whoever held the talking stick was allowed to speak as long as he or she saw fit. Naturally, schizophrenic street people would grab the stick, and we would have to endure endless delusional rants, since there was no organizational method to shut crazy people up and make a damn decision that someone might not agree with. This went on for days, and by the end, we still didn't know where to meet next year. By contrast, the United States Congress seemed a model of decorum, sanity, and efficiency. Back on the road, I headed 90 miles due east to a ranch owned by the Cole family, 7 miles east of Fence Lake, New Mexico. I had known the Coles in Las Cruces in 1987, and they very kindly sent me the gate key in the mail. It didn't work, but I was an ex-con with a hacksaw, so there was little delay. Fence Lake is a tiny settlement of about a dozen people, a little schoolhouse, a post office, and a general store serving local ranchers. There is neither a fence nor a lake. In fact, there's no surface water for a good many miles in any direction. Some time later, I met a couple who rode horses from the Mexican border to Canada. They passed through the fence lake area and were in serious trouble trying to find something for their horses to drink. The nearest population was the Zuni Indian Reservation, some 35 miles to the north, and the nearest real town was 65 miles away. The FM and AM radio stations were in Navajo. I tuned in just to catch the flavor of the language. I had a shortwave radio for living in the outback, but that meant no classical music for long stretches. My first experience with rural roads in Arizona and New Mexico was an education. My suspension was quite stiff, with 75 pounds per square inch in the tires, so the corrugation on the roads resulted in intense vibration. All the containers in my refrigerator turned upside down. The poor desktop computer was shaken to bits. I would open the case and wiggle the cards back into place, but that only worked the first few times. By early the next year, I found an old laptop, which worked well. This was juniper and pinon pine forest, and I foraged for pine nuts until realizing I was allergic to them. My first order of business was to mount Jim's solar panels and rewire the 12-volt system with extra storage batteries. The experience was quite valuable in learning how pointless photovoltaic systems are, which some years later figured into my physics research. I never got out of the system as much energy as required to put it together from raw materials. After a week, I stepped out of my door one morning and barely missed stepping on a green rattlesnake. After quickly dancing out of the way, I stopped to observe and beam some positive waves. After he calmed down and stopped rattling, he started following me around like a long, thin, friendly dog with no legs. The next day, Jerry, Pat, and Eric Cole came up from Las Cruces, and I introduced Jerry to my new pet. I rode around the area with the Coles to find out what was up. In the school's library, there was an article from Look magazine dating from 1956 posted on the wall featuring Fence Lake, describing the town as a dusty, godforsaken wasteland on the other side of nowhere. Back then, the population was 197, but over the years, those who could get out did. Our nearest neighbors to the east were a couple of miles away, and I noticed that there were as many people there as in the town itself. The Coles told me it was a fundamentalist Christian group that had moved there in 1996. This was the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps, kind of a Salvation Army on speed. Jim Green started off in a good Christian home in rural Kentucky, but moved to Satanic California in the 1960s. He and his new wife, Leela, were wired on amphetamines, screaming, "Kill, kill, kill!" and throwing hunting knives to the beat of hard rock music. In the early 1970s, Leela and Jim joined the Bear Tribe, a radical back-to-nature commune of rainbow warriors in Montana, where they lived in a teepee. Jim was known as Buffalo's Son and ran around in a loincloth howling at the moon. Finally, Jesus reached down his hands of mercy and delivered them from the grateful dead, promoting them both to the rank of general. Leela claimed to be God's number one prophet, and they moved to Sacramento, Spanish for sacrament, to set up their cult. In 1989, Maura Schmierer won a lawsuit for $1.2 million, saying they'd forced her to divorce her husband, taken her children, and confined her along with another member in a 5-by-12-foot shed with no window or toilet for 10 weeks. After fleeing to Mozambique and back, the Greens and their entourage moved to other properties, which they lost, eventually ending up as far away from Satan as they could find on the map, Fence Lake. In 2005, General Jim attacked his wife, son Peter, and another man, who in turn beat him with walking sticks. Jim spent 4 days in jail before they apologized to one another and went back to the work of being the army for the Prince of Peace. New Age and Sioux Age. On July 24th, I drove north to Taos, then 20 miles further to Lama Foundation. The road from the highway to Lama is a long dirt track with many switchbacks, not exactly designed with elderly Winnebagos in mind. I managed to keep all 4 wheels on the road. They were recovering well from the fire of 1996, but construction was very much the focus of activity. The people were warm, the spiritual practice was inviting and stimulating, the food was extraordinary, and with my SSI check and Medicaid, I was better off than most residents. I was keen on staying until winter drove me away. The library had a good selection of spiritual books and tapes, but was in a mess of disorganization and neglect. I was hoping I could do my daily work requirement in the library just as I had in prison, as well as some other intellectual tasks, like tutoring Sanskrit. But this was a low priority for Lama, and they didn't think it was enough work. The 8,800-foot altitude exhausted me, as well as the steep mountainside, so I really couldn't manage physical tasks. After 2 weeks, I had to call it quits and went down the mountain. This was my opportunity to visit the beautiful Neem Karoli Baba Ashram in Taos, which is a center of attention for fellow devotees near and far. But this was not a residential ashram, and Taos is expensive. On my way back to Fence Lake, I dropped by Los Alamos to say hi to the Atomic Bomb Museum and atone for the crimes of physics. I pointed out proudly to the receptionist that I had personally pissed off Edward Teller, which was my only notable accomplishment so far in physics. She found this amusing and approved of the effort. I also opined that nuclear weapons were the worst horror the world had ever known, which left her confused. She rarely heard such sentiments in this company town. I had to figure out heat for the winter, and also where to park. Fence Lake would be too cold and isolated, and a dangerous place to have medical problems living alone. I decided to rip out the passenger seat in the front of the RV and put in a wood stove, in true back-to-the-land fashion. I found a good lightweight stove made for horse camping in Minnesota and ordered one. The Coles very generously offered to let me park next to their house in Las Cruces, where I would be able to spend time fixing it up. In late September, I left Fence Lake to visit Phoenix in southeast Arizona before crossing over to Las Cruces for the winter. The road to Phoenix passed through the spectacular Salt River Canyon, which kept my nose glued to the windshield. Good thing I was going downhill. My overloaded RV went up steep hills at 25 miles per hour, much to the aggravation of those lined up behind me. Here, I went downhill in lowest gear next to flatbed trucks, hauling loads of copper ingots billowing smoke from their brakes. In Phoenix, I had a rendezvous with one of the partners in Z-Power, who, like Anton, was always on the verge of big bucks. The horizon constantly receded, in the usual manner of such things, and I never saw any money. They were mostly interested in zero-point energy as the basis for a reactor, which I thought was impossible. Next, I found a woman online interested in esoteric spiritual things who seemed friendly. I parked my Winnebago near her apartment and went in for afternoon tea. She was quite pleasant, then started complaining about her family. They all thought she was nuts, even though she tried to explain to them that she wasn't the same person they knew from before. That person was unhappy here and left her body so that a different person from Arcturus could take over and bless the world with her presence. Thankfully, she absorbed the old Earth memories, so now she had two different pasts to choose from. Then she looked at me accusingly and said, "You think I'm crazy too, don't you?" I gave my best non-committal, "What is reality?" and "Anything is possible" reply, which is always prudent in such situations. Soon after, I retreated to my home on wheels for the night. The next morning, she came out, knocked on my door, and told me to leave immediately. I had been in her dreams and did something she didn't like, although what exactly she wouldn't say. I tried to explain that I had no control over such things, but she would have none of it. Next, I visited Sigmund and Martha and their daughter Anna, not their real names, whom I met kayaking in Camden, Maine, just before arrest. Sigmund ran a kayak rental company using Balog sails and gear, but grew tired of the old biddy next door complaining about his ugly canoes and other bits and pieces of Yankee twaddle. They relocated to as different an environment as possible, the remote stretch of desert on the Mexican border between Bisbee and Sierra Vista. By driving down to Baja, they could use their boats on the Sea of Cortez. They lived in an Airstream in a fifth-wheel trailer while plotting construction of a home. I was impressed by the isolation and beauty of their surroundings and the drama of having a low, two-stranded barbed wire fence a few hundred feet away forming the border with Mexico. Gunshots were not uncommon, and helicopters and border control vehicles came by from time to time. This area was the most active crossing point for illegal aliens and smuggling at the time. More on this later. We paid a visit to Nogales and had a relaxed meal in a restaurant. Being inexperienced in such matters, I trusted their water. The next day, I set off towards New Mexico. An hour or so later, I started feeling ill, and soon I was in real trouble. I was crossing uninhabited desert, periodically vomiting and passing diarrhea, and nearly passing out, resting, then getting back in the driver's seat to make a few more miles before repeating the process. Drinking water was impossible, and I was losing fluids rapidly. I had to get to the main highway in New Mexico to get to a phone and call an ambulance before dehydrating and falling unconscious. If that happened, survival was questionable. I went 80 miles in this manner before finally reaching a truck stop where I stumbled in and asked them to call a hospital. After I was wheeled in the emergency room, before any treatment, they asked me about my insurance and demanded that I sign papers ensuring I would pay them. I had Medicaid in North Carolina, which was no good here. At this point, I was fading in and out and just needed the damn IV saline to stay conscious, so I signed the papers. I told them I'd be applying for Medicaid in New Mexico shortly, that I was indigent and would not pay the bill. They gave me the saline and two Tylenol. I stayed the night and most of the next day before recovering enough to keep driving down the road. The bill they insisted I pay was $2,000. Eventually, Medicaid covered it retroactively. Back in Las Cruces, I parked my rig next to the Coles' handsome and comfortable home, nestled in 10 acres of pecan trees nearing harvest time. Jerry was working on a novel, and Pat made extraordinary quilts. This was an opportunity to tear the cabin apart and put it back together in a more appropriate manner. I even ripped off part of the exterior on one side and replaced it with wood. It was a mess, living with sawdust in the oatmeal and oatmeal in the sawdust. But afterwards, it was a mean green camping machine. Everything was manual, and it took a lot of work to live in it. But now, I would be able to dry camp for 3 weeks without any problem in any weather. The wood stove was a step too far, and in retrospect, hardly rational. But it was unique and did free me from the tyranny of running to the propane store every week in the cold season. I put a triple-wall insulated chimney going straight up from the stove through a corner of the bed that folded down over the front of the cabin. That meant I could sleep very warm right over the stove with a little fire. I made a chimney to fit on the roof that I could detach for traveling. When I'd not quite put out the fire completely and went down the road, it looked like my Winnebago ran on steam. I sold the generator for a song and used its compartment for firewood. There was an elaborate ritual to get the fire going quickly in the morning, using vegetable oil, alcohol, and various other kindling, so that I could have warmth in just a few minutes. Another challenge was putting the fire out fast, since in this climate it could be freezing overnight and hot by 10 a.m. In the end, I found out all the many reasons why RVs use propane instead of wood for heat. Eric was in pretty bad shape, and I learned a lot about schizophrenia by spending time with him. On good days, he thought he was Jesus, and on bad days, it was the other direction. Once he stared at me and said in solemn tones, "I am the son of perdition." To which I replied, "What is perdition?" And with the same solemn tone he said, "I don't know." Some of his visionary experiences sounded a lot like what I'd had with and without psychedelics, but there was always a strange twist that made them pathological. For instance, the UFO that lit up the backyard and spoke to him about how he was loved and directed him to get a job at Taco Bell. Advice for employment like that was certainly a signal from Satan. It was terribly sad to see him suffer. There was always a shuffle of medications, but that was a frustrating dance. There was no social support sufficient to help. If the Coles hadn't had some prosperity in their favor and a deep and loving commitment, Eric would be on the street and then in prison, like so many thousands of others. Mental health facilities for the kind of residential care he needed were all temporary and entirely inadequate, since they shut down the asylums. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was a deplorably successful book. One disturbing thing I noticed was how full the mailbox was every day with deceptive marketing targeted at Eric. There are quite a few companies, such as Publishers Clearing House, who keep lists of the mentally ill and vulnerable elderly. They mail sweepstakes offers and special deals and all kinds of criminal mischief to swindle sick people. There is no particular reason for lawmakers to do anything about it, since laws against fraudulent mail get in the way of campaigning. You can't ask a hustler to outlaw hustling. It was not uncommon for Eric to tell me about some wonderful product he just bought for hundreds of dollars. I would raise the alarm, and most of the time, we could reverse the sale. He was completely defenseless, and in this world, that attracts predators. But at 30 years old, he wanted to live on his own. Like with my arthritis, there just wasn't any fixing this situation. We were in an area noted for pecan orchards, producing something like 6 million pounds of nuts a year. I never saw a squirrel, so the farmers must have been good shots. And soon I thought I heard rifle shots right over my head. It was pecans falling on the metal skin of my roof by the hundreds. I was glad it wasn't coconuts. This was my kind of agriculture.